This is the most dynamic moment probably since World War II in America.
Hey, everybody. It's Friday. My name is Tom Scott. I'm here with RP Eddy. I'm actually looking forward to the weekend. RP, I sat in on one of RP's calls today. Basically, he gathers really impressive and interesting people once a week. Am I right?
Yep.
And they talk about the state of the world. And it gave me a good sense of where he gets at least some of his knowledge, which is a really great resource. And it was great to see. I appreciate you letting me come and spend time there. I also last night, I don't usually watch the Trump press conferences or and I read about them, but last night I watched the most recent one where he outlined the three steps. And I have to say, as I watched it, I thought, okay, you know, this is helpful. This is reasonable. And I left thinking, you know, I'm sure they're going to beat the hell out of him in the media, as they usually might, and in some places, in other places they won't, of course. But I thought, you know, this looks good. This looks reasonable. It gives us something to think about, leaves a lot of power in the hands of the state. And then today, this happens where he's putting up these things. And I'm thinking to myself, man, you know, I had this moment of, you know, I don't know. I cut him a break a little bit. I don't know. I don't like to get into that part of the emotional conversation of the politics that sort of sit behind all this. But I have to say, when I saw that, I felt like, oh, that's disappointing. You know, we're creating a system and a plan, and we're leaving it up to the governors. And then he goes off stage and starts sort of beating them up behind their backs, or not behind their backs, because he's doing it right in the public. So I guess that's how it is. But I'm curious how you just generally reacted to the plan overall, and you know, how solid a plan, and how do you feel about it?
You know, to like just understand the framework, like the president has to get the economy moving. We're entering depression level unemployment. And there's no reason to think without getting us back to work, it's going to change, right? It's a fact. And we didn't deal with the virus early enough, hard enough to allow us to re-enter the workforce, re-enter shops and restaurants, et cetera, safely. So there has to be some kind of way to get there. And so if you want to like talk about blame, you can say, how did we get here? But let's figure out how we're going to get out of here. How are we going to reopen this country? And the president wanted to have America open up the end of this month. He announced a plan yesterday called the middle of the month that gives us sort of 2 weeks to get ready to reopen. It's described as a three-phase plan, easier to understand if you think of it as a four-phase plan. So there's published phase one, two, three. Three being, you know, yippee, we're back. We're going to movie theaters, going to gyms, going to bars. It's all good. Phase one meaning what can you graduate to if you have 14 days of, call it kind of viral, you know, containment. Meaning right now here in New York, we're in phase zero. So phase zero isn't published in the document, but it just makes it easier to think about that way. So you graduate into phase one, and there's what are called gating criteria. So if your region has effectively 14 days of downward trajectory of the virus, and your hospitals are not overrun, then, and that's been 14 days of that, then okay, you get to enter phase one. Right. So you would look at us today and you'd say, all right, let's get 14 days of these things. And then we, meaning New York, then we enter phase one. Say, and then after phase one, you know, you're allowed to ease restrictions a little. And I'm happy with what they describe as the restriction easing in phase one. You're still protecting vulnerable population. You're doing a variety of things that are necessary. If inside phase one, you have 14 days of that same gating criteria, the disease keeps going down, hospitals aren't overrun, and you have, and we'll talk about testing for a second. He does talk about testing a little bit. Then you enter phase two. And phase two is even, you know, a little more free, right? Certain employees can go back to work. You can open up, let me make sure I use the proper words here. You can go back to work, but you should shut down common areas. You can start non-essential travel. meaning you can become a tourist, but you have to be more thoughtful about vulnerable population. That's phase two. And then finally, phase three, again, 14 days of the virus continues to slow down. Phase three is sort of like, it's all good, but make sure you keep washing your hands. Vulnerable individuals need to be extra careful, but don't have to lock themselves away. Now, mom and dad, I'm not saying that's what you should do. That's what the Trump administration is saying to do. That isn't the thing that people should do who will die if they get the disease, right? So if you're a vulnerable population, you have to understand your risk metric differently. This is not described to save you, it's described to open the economy. One last comment. Inside his gating criteria, as I said, he talks about downward trend of the virus, and he talks about hospitals not being overloaded. He also talks about the capacity to test people who are at risk. So you have a testing program for people who are at risk in the workplace, and that you have emerging antibody testing. That's the big difference, the thing you can really poke the difference at between this and the plans that have been offered by the governors of the Western states and the Eastern states. So the unit of analysis and how we get back to work is Donald Trump is suggesting a series of things, which I just described. The West Coast governors are suggesting others. The East Coast governors are suggesting very similar. And as you can imagine, what the governors are describing, the East Coast, West Coast governors, is a little stricter than what Trump is describing. The big difference is they're saying you can't reopen until we can do widespread testing. So the long pole in the California tent, in the West Coast tent, and the East Coast tent, is those governors are saying we're not going to reopen. We're not going to ease back into it the way the president suggests we do, regardless of days, regardless of viral growth, and regardless of flattening the curve, unless we can do widespread testing and tracing. And the bad news is we are nowhere near widespread testing and tracing. Like, and we don't know when we're going to get there, and we don't know where it's coming from. We don't have the tools to do that. So that what we're setting ourselves up for is a bit of a battle between the governors with their own plans of those two blocks, at least, and what the president is suggesting. Now you'll notice I'm talking about the East Coast governors, the West Coast governors. There's then those kind of red state middle governors, and then there's the purple state Midwest governors. So all those are good units of decision making, units of analysis to think about. They all are going to have their own rules. The president has conceded that this is a federalist issue, and the states really have the franchise on what to do here. He's not right, by the way, but that's what he's saying.
Tell me, when you testing as required, that again, my language, what's a reasonable time frame for that?
You know, Tom, you were just on our call with the world's experts in testing. We don't know. They don't know either. Meaning, when will we have the testing that we need? Look, here's the thing that's a real bummer about this. As more people get sick because we don't have enough testing and tracing to stop them, you need more testing and tracing. So your need for testing grows as you're unable to test people and slow them down and understand where they are. There was a New York Times article today about Britain spending $20 million on test kits. You know, Boris Johnson was getting out there and saying, we're going to be able to get everybody test kits, and we're going to go spend $20 million on some Chinese test kits. And they showed up and they don't work. So everyone's scrambling to find test kits. And, you know, what's a real bummer is in some instances we can't do testing because we don't have the swabs, literally the big Q-tips. In some instances we can't test because we don't have the scientific substrate called the reagents. And in some instances we can't do testing because it takes a lot of people and a lot of gowns to do testing. But we are nowhere near where we need to be. Ergo's estimate has been that we will have the necessary testing in July. And I hope that we're being pessimistic.
Okay, but that gives it a good, you know, it at least identifies a window, which I think is helpful. I mean, I'm a little, not being an expert, but sitting through your call, I'm a little less optimistic as I was, say, in the last few days about timing on a vaccine.
Yeah.
And therefore, these other intermediate steps are just more critical.
Yep, that's right. I too, Tom, I've been hoping that, and I think we've been saying optimistically July 2021. What we heard today was 18 months from today. So that's December 2021, right? Oh, no, that's October, November, December 2021. We don't know. So I'd say at this point, we have a variety of expert opinions trying to make a point here. I do believe we had some profound experts talking to us today, you know, former head of vaccine development and a major vaccine manufacturer, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, so how political do you see this becoming?
You know, everything's political in an election year, so we're clearly going to have that. I was thinking about that today, just to, on a side note, how's Biden going to, part of, you know, there's this thing called the Rose Garden advantage, right? You're the president, you have the Rose Garden, you know, you have the media, you know, is on you every day. You have the ability to transmit message. If you're a contender, you don't have that. And the way the contenders generally get media attention is through debates. And we will, now, by the way, the debates aren't mandatory. The president has every right to say, I don't want to do a debate. And in fact, I think Ergo said quite a long time ago, the president will not do debates. Because it just gives a lot more energy to Biden. I mean, months and months pre-corona, we were saying that's a very likely possibility. It's more likely now, right? When's the last time anyone heard of Biden? Like, he's falling out of the news and out of sight, out of mind, out of ballot. It's not good. Now, by no way am I saying Biden's going to lose, but just quickly on that. So you asked how political it will be. It's an election year. Very political. It's the biggest crisis facing America since World War II. Very political. It's World War III. You know, it's another way to think about it. That's what your friend of mine, Barry Sternlicht, was saying the other day in a press conference, in a forum. It's World War III is a way to think about it. Not a bad analogy. The political, it's going to be highly political. And it's already highly political. Now, remember, when I talk about the East Coast bloc and the West Coast bloc, those are all Democratic governors, Democratic states. When I talk about the states in the middle, I call them the red states. We call them the reliant red, self-reliant red states, right? Big part of this Western ethos of being self-reliant. I'll deal with it myself. Thanks for all your help. Those states are GOP states. And then I said purple, talking about the Midwest states, those are swing states. That's red plus blue together. You're not quite sure where they'll go. So they're the most important to Trump's reelection, but he can't lose the red state support also. So it's going to be very political, and it's going to be, I don't know that we'll get there, but imagine this scenario, right? So imagine the New York area comes out of this well and strong. We stay closed down. I think we think that the East Coast isn't opening up till like 5/12, right? A little less than a month from now. I think that's a pretty acceptable number. That's a pretty good long run to flatten this curve, even though we haven't implemented as strict quarantines as Italy or as China or other places. If we stick where we are in one more month, the viral load will be much lower, right? That's good. So we worked really hard for it. We paid a real price for that, a huge price, right? In all sorts of terms. Other states have decided not to do that. And other states are spiking right now. The biggest spike right now is in South Dakota. If I'm the governor of Connecticut, who I think is doing a very good job, by the way, if I'm the governor of Connecticut, I am strongly going to consider, how do I keep my border strong so we don't have contaminated people coming into my state where we paid this high price to lock down, other places didn't. That's the definition of political, right? You have Democratic states effectively saying Republicans can't come into our state, you know. Not only political, it's a constitutional challenge. It's fascinating. We're not going to get there. You know, Rhode Island did it a little bit with the Rhode Island Highway Patrol stopping people on the exits and saying, hey, if you're from New York and you're coming to Rhode Island, we're not going to stop you from coming in, although they do have the right to do that. That's, you know, it would be a Supreme Court case, but I would say they do. We're not going to prevent you from coming in, but you got to self-quarantine for 14 days. They didn't really enforce it, but they certainly have legal right to enforce it. So they could say, Tom, fine, what address are you going to? Go there. And if you come out of that house in 14 days, you're going to get fined. Yeah. And, you know, I would.
Is it fair to say that it seems to be the case that we have flattened the curve well enough to not be in the situation where there's not an adequate distribution of ventilators, et cetera?
Yes.
For now. Okay, so that was a bullet that we seemingly dodged.
That's right. That is one piece of very good news, and we should you know put a candle in and light it. It appears so you remember this. To me, remember, we don't learn through stats, we learn through stories. And one of the things that really moved me was that letter from Northern Italy from a doctor saying, like, do you actually know what's happening here? Interesting thing about people dying in hospitals is you don't see it on camera. In America, we have HIPAA protections. Other countries, they have their own equivalent of it. So if someone was dying in a school shooting or someone was dying in a stadium, you know, you see it, right? Like you see all sorts of horror. Someone dies in a hospital, it's unfortunately in this disease, it's alone because of all the containment, but it's also behind doors, right? And then, you know, for example, what is it, 17 people or some larger number died in a nursing home? Those are all silent deaths, right? So this letter from Italy was saying, these are happening, here's a narrative of it, I'm hitting your limbic system with the tail, and they have to make these triage decisions about who gets the ventilator. Does grandpa get it or does grandson get it? And whoa, I mean, we don't want that. And that is one of those social signposts that if that was starting to happen here, people would freak out even more than they have freaked out because that story would come out. It didn't happen here. And we appear to be over that. Now, if everyone runs out and decides to go slosh around and play, get too close to each other, then it could spike again.
So, knock on wood, we've done a decent job of that. If we stay inside till about May 12th, we should be even better, theoretically. And then we begin to reemerge. And if you look at some of the phase two or even the phase one stipulations, those basic practices of like relative social distance, even within the same buildings, wearing a mask, maybe wearing gloves, cleaning the hands. Does that have a major impact? Is that pretty darn effective?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Remind me, ask me about New York in a second, but is that effective? Yes. An N95 mask, right? That's kind of this gold standard mask. Wearing an N95 mask properly, which isn't easy, and then using proper aseptic behaviors with the mask reduces your chance of infection by, guess what percentage?
We have no idea.
500%.
Wow.
Yeah. So now aseptic behaviors, I would imagine very few people on this call, if you haven't been a doc or something, know what that means. Like, how do you take a mask on and off? How do you use the gloves? How do you hand wash? What's the sequence? So if you're going to go wear a mask, go Google aseptic behavior videos and see the sequence of how you do it, right? So just imagine I have a mask on, I'm touching a surface. I go to touch my mask, take my mask off. The outside of my mask is probably already contaminated. It's nominally the job of the mask. I've either contaminate my hands, et cetera. So there's a process you have to follow. It's worth understanding how to do it. Yes, totally works. It works. Gloves, gloves don't protect you the same way a mask does. You know, you get the disease through your mouth, your eyes, or your nose. Gloves can just be a reminder to take them off. So you have to do it properly, right? So you're removing the virus from your hands. You go to the grocery store, you have gloves on. The virus is nominally on your gloves. Take the gloves off. The virus is now nominally in the garbage can. Wash your hands. But remember, those gloves are a contaminated item or vector, so they have to not be sitting on your kitchen counter, right? Because now you're actually carrying a mass of the disease in. But short answer, yes, that stuff works.
Okay, so from that point of view, it's reasonable to give a lot of thought towards, we missed the really bad thing. I mean, there's plenty of bad. I don't want to undersell the bad because there's plenty of bad. But we so far have missed the really bad thing, which is the overloading of the hospitals and the ventilators. We're probably not going to get to the really good place for 12, 14, whatever months, because that's how long it's going to take to get through the ventilation, the vaccination period. And therefore, we're going to have to really learn how to do this middle place. The way we behave in public, the things we wear, the things we do, the way we conduct our businesses. I mean, it's interesting because if you look at phase two, at least in the Trump plan, you know, he's talking, you can visit seniors in health, in care facilities. Large venues, including sit-down dining, movie theaters, sporting venues, places of worship, can operate under moderate physical distancing protocols. Gyms can remain open if they have physical distance protocols, et cetera.
Sanitation, yeah.
So what is that? I mean, that are we phase two in July around New York?
No. Oh, July. Well, okay, first of all, we don't have to, as I said, the Trump plan is less strident. I would argue that we can open the economy quickly and more safely with a few different steps that are in the plan, part one. I'd also make the really explicit point that at risk, you know, we talked about this a long time ago, but don't forget that risk equals consequence times likelihood. So again, my conversation with my parents, my dad's going to see this, I guaranteed. And he's going to say, oh, look at this. Wait, I'm going to do the math. 14 days, your mom and I can go out and play bridge with our friends. And whatever it is, not 14 days, but whatever it is by 28 days or something. And I'm going to have to describe again that, you know, please don't, because the consequence of doing so is so profound. Even if it's a 1% chance, there's 100 M&Ms on the table, Dad. You guys want to go play bridge? One of those M&Ms is cyanide. Would you like some M&Ms? That, you know, remember this. So the Trump plan is too lax on some functions. I would say particularly that, vulnerable populations and testing.
I had two former teachers who both passed away last week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In both cases, I thought I understood the story, which I did not. And it turned out they both had died from corona.
Oh, man.
And they were both old. And, you know, this is lame science, of course, but when I found out the truth, I thought, my God, I mean, if you're old and you get this disease, the risks are just so intense. It's just very hard for me to imagine me feeling comfortable with my own parents or anyone in that place of risk anytime soon.
Yeah.
Now, maybe I don't know enough about the protocols and the distancing and all the other questions. And okay,
no, I mean, it's look, remember what Adam Robinson said the other day too, which is, first of all, people just make stupid mistakes all the time. The brightest people do. Yo-Yo Ma leaves his cello in a taxi. And in this instance, we're more prone to be stupid, right? There's increased stress, et cetera. So this is a place where we're going to make more stupid mistakes. And it only takes one. So look, I think we should spend some time thinking about how to be safer when we reemerge and understanding how to do that. And maybe we should even have someone come on and talk about aseptic practice and all that kind of stuff, because it's critical. But I have some more good news. Such a macabre thing to have as good news. But New York State, now this is not my model, and I don't know why I have my model open and someone else's model open, but I presume ours are close enough. Today is projected to be the peak of deaths per day in New York today. So let's say a prayer for the 840 people who are going to die today from corona. And there's probably hoping against hope that that number is too high. And then let's watch that number goes to 700, to 600, to 5, to 4, to 3, to 2. And let's hope that today is the peak of deaths in New York State.
Do you have an opinion on, I'm reading more and more about how early the virus may have arrived here. Saw something today that said November. I've heard beginning of January. Do you have any intel on that?
Part of why it matters is there is this optimistic view that, and you have this conversation with folks, I think you and I had this conversation. Oh man, in late December, I just had this wicked flu. I think I got corona and got over it. I'm antibody positive, I'm okay. And if that's the case with me, must be millions of Americans who've already gotten it, antibody positive. And that means the lethality rate is lower, right? Because that wouldn't be in the denominator. The one that we're currently using, and people are, there's a whole safe workforce. And maybe you start even getting towards the study of herd immunity. There's just so many folks who got the disease we didn't know. And that would have been nice. Turns out it's not the case. No, that did not happen. So I don't have it in front of me. I think we're pretty confident about the first day this thing showed up, more or less. You can, epidemiological tracing can let you get really accurate to this. HIV is different, right? So HIV, it turns out there were these interesting reports of people that had died, I think going back into like maybe the 30s, 40s, and 50s with HIV. And in some instances, they still had some blood available from people in the 60s and 70s. So that thing had kind of lingered around in different areas. And it, the epizootic shift from animals to humans had probably happened a number of times because it lives in the natural reservoir of monkeys. And I think that's what I think I'm kind of forgetting, that it had probably jumped over a few times. There's no reason to think that this SARS-CoV-2, this particular disease, had jumped over previously. So I would say, you know, I don't think it got here earlier.
Okay. And you know, I saw the PGA. They're going to launch without fans. But you know, Trump himself said it. Like he sees full stadiums in the fall. He said he sees 110,000 people watching the Alabama football game in Alabama.
And what in the fall? Well, let's hope so. You know, like remember what we're talking about. Just to make sure we understand the context of this is. If we had done a South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, you know, the litany of countries style lockdown, even Italy, where we knew and we had the testing and the tracing, right? So first, if like looking in the rearview mirror, we said every sick person was identified and quarantined and treated. Some survived, some died, but like we're done with that. The sick people have all been identified. And the disease is no longer moving around, which is what those countries now believe is the case. South Korea got to the point where they had like one or zero cases per day identified. It went back up because of international travel, but they got their country clean, right? And if you do that, shit, you can go do anything you want, right? The disease is literally gone from our country if it's not sneaking back in. And as we said before, it doesn't naturally live amongst humans, right? It's not going to pop back out. There are no wet markets and pangolins and bats in America. So it'd be gone. We have not done that. That's why I'm not as excited about the Trump plan, because let's imagine again, my grandparents. So they're in Florida. Let's imagine Florida like, wow, look, we've had 28 days of Florida just being perfect. No tests. We'll never get there, but or not until the vaccine, but no positive tests and everything's good. And it doesn't appear the disease is here. You know, come on, can't we leave our house now and go see our friends and go over swim in the pool? Sure, if you lived in South Korea or if you lived in a country where they actually are going to lock down travel and there aren't people milling all over the place, because Florida is one of, there's 49 other states, even with international travel cut down where people are moving around. So it's that transmission of the virus that's the concern.
Yeah. Well, it's, I spoke today with one of the leaders of a very big tech company and, today. And, you know, he was talking about the nature of his reality, which is overwhelming. You know, it is for so many people. But it was among the things he said that was most interesting to me is the world that's going to be built after this. So all the things that they've been doing now, let's say up to now, are going to be very different set of things that they're going to do sort of in this next phase. And they're going to do them in very different ways. I mean, one of the things that's so critical to business generally is this communication, you know, literally being with people and telling your stories and sharing your ideas and then interacting and building up with each other. And, you know, frankly, businesses like mine, which is the reason I have this relationship, those things matter to people. It's how those relationships are built. It's how they can talk about those things. It's how they can get excited about all those things. Those things are all gone. Mm-hmm. Conferences, dinners, golf trips, even, you know, those kinds of things, or just meeting in somebody's office,
having a barbecue in the backyard. Yeah. Christenings. I mean, yeah.
It's a huge deal. And it's, and so he talked a lot about that, is they have to completely rethink the way they do business in a way they never imagined they'd have to think.
And you're referring to while they're dealing with the risk of the disease, or are you referring to how he thinks the world's going to change?
A little bit of both. But I mean, the primary part of the conversation is, can you help me communicate in this difficult interim period? And that's what that conversation
was. What do you, Tom, I'd love to have a conversation at some point about probably best to do it sector by sector, behavior by behavior, but what I'd love to have a conversation, we just not do it now, but we should talk about what, how the world will be different at the end of this. Right. So I think it's enlightened to believe it's probably less enlightened to say, ah, the vaccines are here, back to life is normal, nothing will change. Well, that's not the case, right? So it's not gonna be that. And alternatively, I don't believe we're all gonna walk out and for months be freaked out about seeing and touching people post-vaccine. And I'm just curious, you know, at some point it'd be worth understanding your view on where you think we will end up.
Well, it was the beginning of a conversation that he and I had today. You know, it's funny, I'm just finishing The Power Broker, the story of Robert Moses. And he played a very big role. Say again?
By Kara.
Yeah, and he played a huge role in the shape of this gigantic metropolis down the street, right? How it was organized, who it focused its efforts on, and why, and how, and what did it celebrate, and what didn't it celebrate? So we're at this incredible cultural moment, but we're also in an incredible technological moment. Like the technological capabilities of these cities today is extraordinary. One of the things that's happening is you're rethinking the social construct right now. So when cities organize themselves in the next phase, they're not going to think about it in the same way as the old phase. And that impacts so many of us in a whole variety of ways. And, you know, and the other part of it is it used to be the case that a lot of these tech companies and let's say road builders and bridge builders, simple things like that, not that they're simple. They had like five versions. You can have this one, or this one. Nowadays, with the way technology works, you have an infinite number of solutions. You have an infinite number of ways to organize these things. Just the conversation we had the other day with your friend in the restaurant business. You can rethink that in lots of different ways.
Michael Astoria from N Pizza. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and then the other one he talked a lot about was this, is that you know, this kind of communication has altered the way people are thinking about these things. And someone on the call said something to the effect of, everyone's saying, I hope your family's okay, which is nice. But when you heard it from the 32nd time and everyone's hearing it 32 times, it starts to lose its meaning. And because we're doing it like this, what is the nature of relationship and how is that relationship built and why does it matter? In the old days, when you went to go play golf with a client, you actually thought to a certain extent you were playing golf, even though you knew underlying there was a, well, when that goes away and you're like, hey, how might I get RP to buy something from me now? Well, it changes the nature of the reality of the way you think about it.
That's interesting. I'm finding that pre-existing friendships and relationships can get strengthened through this.
Yeah, I agree.
Ours being an example. But I wonder, I haven't thought about it, but I wonder if I don't want to quite say categorically, is it going to be a whole lot harder to build new relationships, right? So I'm finding that old friends are buckling down and supporting each other, but is it much harder to build as meaningful new friends virtually? It's kind of, I'd imagine.
He made the point that business relationships are going to be required to be more authentic. More authentic, that's a hopeful statement.
Can you be authentic? Can you be authentic over Zoom? You can.
I think you can to a certain extent. I think you can. I think it's better than many of the methodologies we've used in the past. But there's also that notion of
better than a fax machine.
but I'm saying it's way better than the phone. Yeah. Like way better.
Yeah.
But his point was some of the protocols of behavior, some of the political relationships that are built in corporations at this moment are breaking down. Because it's the whole construct is different. So he's like, in his massive corporation, he's like, I've got to speak very frankly with people in a way that in the past you could sort of be more surface and political. I mean, the other part of this, which I do find very refreshing, is there are very few businesses that aren't suffering. So you can talk about it openly. You're not the one loser business that's failing and you don't want your employees to be afraid. Well, your employees are definitely afraid. I mean, in 80% of the businesses to some extent. And that just opens up that authentic channel in a way that we just haven't had this before.
And you know, who becomes your silent colleague is your backdrop. It's just like people are very, 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 very identified with what's behind them on the camera.
Well, it's funny because when Kristen was on your, cause I was at RP's thing and I have to admit that I didn't want to look like the Joker with the tools in your business, because your business is more sophisticated than mine, frankly. And then when I saw Kristen, another colleague of mine was on the show, and I saw Kristen, and she actually looked professional. And I was like, oh, good. Kristen looks like she belongs. I got to turn my camera off because I don't belong. Anyway. Anyway, I appreciate it. Let's enjoy the weekend. And I think we come back and dig into more of this on some of the practical things. And, you know, I have to say, I've been doing a lot of communication with a couple of municipalities and other people in businesses like mine. And it's really interesting, the black boxes that people are looking into, because the knowledge base is pretty limited.
Yeah.
You know, if you're running a small town, if you're the mayor of a small town, it's very difficult for you to understand. These people are making really big decisions that heavily impact the economy of their small place, whatever their place is, and they don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot. I think black box is a good way of putting it. You know, this is it's a highly complex, very novel topic for lots of people, and we're only a month or so into it, and it's like a lot to learn, and it also plays against our biases, so it's hard to learn a lot of it.
Well, in one of the areas that I was speaking to, they said that this municipality has canceled any group gatherings through July, and they're probably going to cut August. When I heard that, I thought, that's a big call. Like, that they know how long.
Why bother? Why bother? Why? You don't need to do that.
Anyway, and you know, by the way, there's the other side of that equation too. There's other people who are just like, yeah, go for it. I'm like, I don't know if that's the right move either.
Yeah.
So.
The Nantucket project's going to become the South Dakota project?
Yeah, it could. No, that ain't happening. Okay. RP, thanks for being here. We'll be in touch next week.
Thanks, Tom. Great seeing you.
See you guys.